Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Vijay Prashad, professor of international studies and author, who discusses the shocking terrorist attacks in Paris, the goals of the perpetrators, and policy options to diminish future cycles of violence. Jacqueline Patterson of the NAACP's Environmental and Climate Justice Program, who talks about the continuing effort to make the climate movement more inclusive of communities of color. And Matt Dos Santos of the ACLU of Oregon, who examines the recent revelation that the Oregon Department of Justice had covertly surveilled state residents who used the Black Lives Matter hashtag in their Twitter feeds. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On the fifth anniversary of her release from house arrest, pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi and her party, the National League for Democracy, or NLD, won a majority of seats in Myanmar's, formerly Burma's, parliament and the right to form a new government. Myanmar's 2008 constitution, written by the military, bars Suu Kyi from becoming president, but the democracy crusader insists, as party leader, she will be above the president. The NLD swept out the ruling party of former generals, the Union Solidarity and Development Party, defeating many cabinet members. This is the most open election in Myanmar since 1990, when the NLD won a large majority in parliament, but the ruling military junta at the time never recognized the election results and put Suu Kyi, a Nobel Prize winner, under house arrest for most of the past two decades. In the recent election, the generals had hoped to maintain their majority with the aid of ethnic political parties, but those groups voted heavily for Aung San Suu Kyi's party. Despite the opposition's landslide election victory, the military retains plenty of power. The military is allotted 25% of all seats in parliament, and the generals can name powerful ministers, including defence, home affairs, and border control. The army also retains powerful business interests in ruby and jade mines, tobacco and banking. Pushed by social conservatives, several southern states, including Texas, Tennessee and Florida, are now debating the so-called Pastor Protection Act that supporters say would prohibit ministers from being forced to perform same-sex marriages. Yet the legislation is purely symbolic, since the First Amendment to the US Constitution protects clergy from having to perform ceremonies or religious rituals against their will. The push for the bill came as the US Supreme Court legalized same-sex marriage across the US. Social conservatives have reacted to new rights for gays and lesbians by calling for laws to protect religious freedom. Despite their allies' current effort, the right-wing Family Research Council recognizes churches and ministers currently have solid protection, and they assert that there's no appreciable risk that clergy would be compelled by a court to host or perform a same-sex wedding. So why are the conservatives pushing for the symbolic Pastor Protection Act, which was signed into law by Texas GOP Governor Greg Abbott in June? Florida pastor Harold Thompson of the Miami Beach Community Church says the true intent of this bill is not to protect pastors, it is not to protect the church, it is to protect an agenda. It is nothing more than a wolf in sheep's clothing, intending to deceive, intending to harm. New York City's progressive mayor Bill de Blasio has launched an ambitious plan to create 80,000 units of new affordable housing and preserve 120,000 units of low-cost apartments. Yet the plan and its reliance on mandatory inclusionary zoning will not be enough, according to many housing advocates who are calling for policies that do more to aid cash-strapped poor New Yorkers. The de Blasio zoning scheme calls for a range of set-asides for affordable units in exchange for granting private developers higher density in new buildings. City Limits magazine reports that the zoning requirement sets aside 20-30% of all units, double the current rate of affordable units built through zoning in other cities. But little of the new housing would be offered to families who make half of New York City's average median income, complains Moses Gates of the Association for Neighborhood and Housing Development. Tom Angotti, a professor of urban affairs at Hunter College, says the city's supply-side approach is flawed since market-rate development in New York City means luxury housing. With low vacancy rates, advocates say the de Blasio administration should focus more on preserving existing affordable housing and building new low-cost units on city-owned land rather than relying upon private developers. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
The shocking terrorist attacks in Paris on November 13th focused world attention on ISIS, the extremist group which claimed responsibility. The well-planned massacre of ordinary Parisians across the city, in restaurants, a stadium, and concert hall, killed 129 and wounded 352, with 99 remaining in critical condition. In a statement released after the carnage, the terrorist group said it had targeted France for its involvement in the bombing campaign against ISIS forces in both Iraq and Syria. The Paris assault came after other recent attacks claimed by ISIS, including two bombings in Beirut that killed 43, the bombing of a Russian airliner over Egypt that took the lives of 224 passengers, and a double suicide bombing in Ankara, Turkey, targeting a Kurdish political rally that killed 97. The French government responded to the murderous attack by invoking a state of emergency, stepping up its bombing campaign against ISIS in Syria, and launching police raids against suspected ISIS-linked terrorists across France. While President Obama has resisted calls to send large numbers of U.S. troops to battle ISIS in Syria, Republican presidential candidates were quick to criticize the president for not escalating America's military campaign, with some demanding a halt to a White House plan to resettle 10,000 Syrian war refugees in the U.S. They were joined by two dozen Republican governors who said they would suspend the resettlement of Syrian refugees in their states. Your reporter spoke with Vijay Prashad, the George and Martha Kellner Chair in South Asian History and Professor of International Studies at Trinity College. Here, Professor Prashad discusses the goals of the perpetrators of the Paris massacre and policy options to diminish future cycles of violence.
There is indeed an apocalyptic vision. The magazine, very glossy magazine, produced by ISIS is called Dabiq. Dabiq is a town in Syria, a small town, where there is a kind of legendary idea that that is where the final battle will take place. In the apocalypse indeed will happen. You don't forget that Islam, Judaism, they share this view that there is an end times, that there's an apocalyptic moment. And so this should be familiar to people who are raised in these, as it were, Abrahamic religions, where there is this sort of end time philosophy. So yes, there is a section of ISIS that is indeed, believes in an apocalypse. They want to certainly draw in, troops from the West. And they're going to have, engineer this big battle in Dabiq, and there's the end of the world. There are sections like that. There are also people in ISIS who have politics, who are angry with the dispensation. They want to create room for themselves. They are not necessarily motivated by this apocalyptic vision. You know, they've been frustrated with the government in Iraq. They're frustrated with the government in Syria. So there are people like that. And these are the people that are not programmatically committed to the ideology of ISIS. And if they are squeezed, they would walk away from ISIS. You know, these are the low-hanging fruit. Then there are people who live in Europe who are frustrated with the way the domestic policies in Europe, racism, with poverty among, immigrants from Algeria and Morocco. You know, France has the largest, population of North Africans, given miserable conditions. Belgium has, one of the poorest areas of Belgium is entirely North African. So the point I'm making is there are many different motivations for acts of terror. We have to understand them for their multiplicity, and you have to forensically go after different populations based on, what kind of drivers they have. If there are those who are driven by an apocalyptic vision, it's very unlikely to be able to convince them of anything. But the vast bulk of people who join terrorist organizations aren't hardened ideological militants. They have all kinds of opportunistic ideas that draw them to terrorism. And those are the people that need to be politically appealed to. The United States and its allies have been bombing ISIS since August of 2014. And apart from one example, there have been almost no gains. I mean, ISIS works like a pendulum. It doesn't sit in one place. It's 10,000 or so fighters are always on the move. And unfortunately, that's exactly what the French have now ramped up and bombing more in Raqqa. Very unlikely it's going to have an effect.
Well, Vijay Prashad, just a final question here. Regional and world powers involved in the Syrian civil war have been working at cross purposes for a number of years now. Do you think these recent terrorist attacks targeting Russia and France and other regional centers of power may offer some hope for these countries to come together to try and address and end the war in Syria and thereby go at the root of the problem when it comes to ISIS and the havoc they've wreaked across the globe?
Scott, this is a very important question. You know, Obama and Putin had a 35-minute meeting where they sat at the margins of the G20 summit, actually in the reception area in Antalya, Turkey, and they spent 35 minutes talking. And what the Russians said after that meeting was that the Obama and Putin agreed broadly on the strategy for Syria. There was disagreement on the tactics. Now, they didn't explain exactly what tactics they were talking about, but this is a slightly positive way forward. You know, I'm not a believer in great powers solving the problems of ordinary people. You know, I would believe ordinary people solve their own problems. But here, Syria is being suffocated. Half the population has been displaced. The dropped by more than 10 years in these 5 years itself. So something needs to be done. And if it's going to take some kind of agreement between these big powers, if they're going to be able to twist the arms of regional powers and create some drawdown in Syria, any kind of approach should be welcomed by the world. Syria needs to have some semblance of breathing room. And I think if they can provide it, then we should welcome that.
That was Vijay Prashad, professor of international studies at Trinity College and author of 17 books, including The Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World. For more analysis and commentary on the world's response to the latest ISIS terrorist attacks, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The U.S. environmental movement has long had a reputation for attracting mostly white, middle-class activists. But for many decades, the struggle for environmental justice has been fought out in overwhelmingly low-income communities of color that border some of the nation's most polluting industries. In 2009, the NAACP hired Jacqueline Patterson, the first director of the group's Environmental and Climate Justice Program. The program, she explains, was established because at the time, there was no visible racial justice component inside any of the nation's mainstream climate organizations. Over the past 6 years, Patterson has been at the forefront of helping frontline communities integrate climate activism into their agenda and pushing big green environmental groups to integrate a social justice lens into their daily work. Jacqueline Patterson was one of the speakers at the third annual Climate Stewardship Summit on November 5th in West Hartford, Connecticut, sponsored by the Interreligious Eco-Justice Network. In an interview with Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, Patterson discusses some of the successes a more integrated movement has achieved and the challenges that remain.
When we talk about intersectionality in this climate space, it's about the fact that the same entities that are pushing back on having regulations for clean air, pushing back on incentivizing and supporting research and development and the expansion of clean energy and even energy efficiency, are the same entities that are also pushing for stripping of voting rights and suppressing the vote in certain areas. And the same folks who would vote in favor of the types of regulations that we need, the folks who are most impacted by dirty air and so forth, are the folks whose votes are being suppressed. So we just see a whole intersection between environmental issues and the types of policies that we need, and issues around voting rights and voter suppression.
So there was a question raised by a white woman, and I'm saying race because I think it's relevant to the point, that, you know, she looked around the room and most of the people, probably at least 90% of the people here, are white people. I think her point was, well, you know, we have to get everybody involved in this. And the first answer that was given to her by an African-American man was, you know, it's survival issues that a lot of black people are struggling more just to survive. And so they're thinking, you know, the next hour, the next meal, and not necessarily down the road, even though they may understand the issues and they may want to get involved. Do you agree with that analysis?
That is true, certainly, of some people, for sure. And I think he, you know, obviously if there had been more time to have a longer conversation, I think he raised that as one point. I don't think he was saying that explained the whole thing. And so I followed up by saying also that there are folks who are engaging on the front lines of environmental and climate justice struggles because, again, they're the ones who have those things in their backyard. They're the ones who have the high rates of asthma. They're the ones who have people dying of lung disease, even though they've never smoked a day in their lives. I mean, they're the ones who are facing all of this. And so the communities I work with, there's communities all over the country that are engaged in this all day, every day. One of the questions is why it is that this group isn't connected to those groups. So I think that's kind of the bigger question we need to ask in terms of, you know, what kind of relationships we need to be building at the local level so that, you know, if there's a group, you know, doing this work all day, every day, and then there's another group having a similar conversation someplace else, why it is that they're not connecting together. And so those are some of the questions I'd love to see asked. And then also, there are communities. When we first did our report called Cold-Blooded Putting Profits Before People, where we were looking at coal-fired power plants throughout the country, there were definitely communities where the coal plants might be right in their backyard, but they would say to us, you know, we drive past that thing every day and we never tied it to the fact that half the people in our church are in respirators and half the kids in our schools are carrying asthma inhalers every day. We just never made that connection because this is just the way our lives are. Like, this is just the state of affairs. We didn't know necessarily that it's different from any other community. And so we really started to have some conversations around these connections. And as I said in answer to that same question before as well, that people haven't done a good job, the big environmental groups, in messaging these real human impacts. They've been talking about the polar bears, the ice caps, the bees, you know, all these different things that people don't necessarily tie to their everyday lives. And so we really have started with a whole story collection piece. And that's what we really focused on, is collecting stories around climate change and how it's affecting communities so that people do see it through a story-based lens.
Do you feel like either the Sierra Club or any other, I mean, they're the biggest grassroots based of the Big Greens, but do you feel like the Sierra Club or any other quote unquote Big Green group has been making progress toward incorporating issues of climate justice into their work?
That's the one thing that I've seen in the evolution over the 6 years, that there has been definitely more of a leaning in and more of a conversation around how these different issues intersect. Sierra Club in particular, they have a great environmental justice program, and they have made a commitment to diversity and inclusion and doing training around that throughout the organization. So that's been positive. They explicitly leaned into the Black Lives Matter movement, and that's been positive as well. And there are conversations about not leaning into other issues in a quid pro quo way, like we're going to do this and then we want you to do that, but really recognizing that these issues are directly intersectional. The fact that Black lives are devalued in association with interactions with the police is related to the fact that Black lives are devalued in that the Black communities are disproportionately dumped on or contaminated and polluted. So it's really all the same conversation. It's not trading engagement. Also, Sierra Club, Greenpeace, Earth Justice, and Union of Concerned Scientists and others, some of these big greens, have leaned into this process called the Building Equity and Alignment Initiative, which is a collaboration between grassroots frontline community groups, big green organizations, and foundations, where they're all coming together to really talk explicitly about how we can change the way we're doing this and how we can center anti-oppression work and, you know, real frontline community leadership in advancing this movement.
That was Jacqueline Patterson, director of the NAACP's Environmental and Climate Justice Program. For more information on the group's climate and justice work, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On November 10th, the Criminal Justice Division of the Oregon Department of Justice revealed that it had secretly spied on state residents who used the Black Lives Matter hashtag in their Twitter accounts. Among those surveilled was the state's own Director of Civil Rights, Arias Johnson. In response to a letter signed by a number of Oregon groups, including the Urban League of Portland, the state AFL-CIO, the ACLU of Oregon, and several chapters of the NAACP, Oregon's Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum stated that she was shocked and appalled by the surveillance conducted by a Department of Justice investigator employed in the state's Criminal Justice Division. The groups collectively expressed their outrage for what they said was the improper and potentially unlawful surveillance and investigation of an Oregonian merely for expressing a viewpoint or for being part of a social movement. The ACLU of Oregon went further by characterizing state spying on legally protected political speech on Twitter as racial profiling, offensive, and a serious threat to our democracy. Together, these progressive groups submitted a list of demands to the Attorney General that included a call for an immediate halt to the surveillance, a thorough independent public investigation, and an apology. The local chapter of the ACLU has filed records requests to state agencies, the U.S. Department of Justice and FBI, seeking information on the extent of the surveillance, the technology used, and those who were profiled. Your reporter spoke with Matt Dos Santos, legal director with the ACLU of Oregon, who talks about the many unanswered questions surrounding the surveillance, its motivation, and the need for a full and transparent investigation into these activities.
We were approached by both the Attorney General's office and the Urban League of Portland, who conveyed the situation to us. And, you know, while we've been told by the Attorney General that the surveillance was stopped as soon as she found out about it, we still don't really know how long the surveillance was actually happening.
So was any rationale offered for their engaging in the surveillance?
Well, look, it's unclear right now, and certainly the stuff that we've heard isn't particularly palatable. The AG has suggested that it may have been a rogue employee playing with a demo of software, but that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. It also contradicts her previous statements that the Criminal Justice Division was looking for information about anti-police sentiment or violence in conducting the surveillance.
I did want to ask you about a particular individual who was apparently targeted or identified in the surveillance, and that's an individual named Arias Johnson, who I believe is the state's director of civil rights. In what context were they surveilling this state official?
So that's a really great question for the Criminal Justice Division of the Department of Justice, and one that we honestly hope we can get answered soon. What we've heard so far is that the Criminal Justice Division was looking for anti-police sentiment or violence. But like I said, that's a tough pill to swallow, given that they actually looked into, in some depth, their own Director of Civil Rights. I mean, we think that this constitutes racial profiling. And at least the upside of some of the comments that the Attorney General has made, in addition to just generally saying that she's outraged by what is happening, is she appears to also believe that this is racial profiling. We have a task force, actually, that was put together on racial profiling, on which the Attorney General and the ACLU of Oregon are both participants. And so we hope to hear a little bit more about that. You know, I think it's important to remember that the Black Lives Matter movement is Black-led. And, you know, it's important to remember that the Black Lives Matter movement is a peaceful political movement with really important concerns and questions about police violence in communities of color and this very thing we're talking about, racial profiling.
Matt, tell us about the coalition of groups that have
risen to the challenge here of these revelations of surveillance of the Black Lives Matter movement. Who's involved in pressing the government of Oregon to investigate and reveal really what's been going on here?
So the Urban League of Portland was the author of the letter. It came from Nikenge Harmon Johnson, who was actually married to the Civil Rights Division director, Arias Johnson. And so they've certainly been involved in this event and the revelations leading up to where we are today. Other organizations that are involved are the Center for Intercultural Organizing, the NAACP, APANO, which is one of our stalwart groups that look out for the Asian Pacific Islander community here in Portland. And so that whole community of folks were concerned because they know for a fact that their members are using this hashtag Black Lives Matter every day. And certainly that was one of the reasons why the ACLU of Oregon was so concerned, because we think our members have a right to talk about this really important issue without the threat of government surveillance.
And what specifically is this coalition of groups asking the government of Oregon to do here in response to these revelations?
So the letter that was initially sent to the Attorney General called for a few things. One of them was an immediate halt to digital and other surveillance of Black Lives Matter related topics and individuals who might be using that particular hashtag. We called for an independent audit to determine who at the Oregon Department of Justice created and authorized this, quote, threat assessment practice, when it began, whether the investigations included email, browser history, phone and other online or offline activity, and what were the department's intentions in creating that program, and what frankly has been done with that information, whether it was shared with other local, state, county, or federal organizations. And we also asked for whether the Criminal Justice Division was properly supervised or trained to avoid racial bias. I think that's going to be really important for us to understand. And finally, an apology and disclosure to all Oregonians who were ensnared in this dragnet.
That was Matt Dos Santos, legal director with the ACLU of Oregon. Find more information on the Oregon Department of Justice surveillance of state residents by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Reese, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.